This is a reading from the Albigen Papers by Richard Rose, the second paper titled Psychology and the Truth. The path to truth begins with the self. We cannot properly identify the self, isolate it, or analyze it because it is the subject of which man knows the least. We know that which we are talking about us is us, but if a convinced monist is talking to him, the self might be entirely different than the self that is contemplated by the dualist. Despite interpretations, we still must try to find out that which we are, and that in turn may involve that which we were and that which we will be. Up until now, most of us accepted ourselves without any examination. We did not know who we were or whence we came, but if anyone dared to challenge the pseudo-reality of our existence, we had recourse to a game of dotting the challenger's eyes with the fists, and followed this by asking the educated recipient for the identity of the person who dotted his eyes. This is a little trick known as parrying a question with a question. We accept much. We like to call it faith. But faith is a carryover from the trusting days of childhood when we had no alternative to trust. Maybe there never will be an alternative, but then perhaps maybe we can carry the childish trust too far. We clutch at promises, at words, at euphemisms, at magic mirrors even. To wean ourselves, we must learn to doubt, to compare, to analyze, and also to synthesize. We must have the courage to question authority. We must have the maturity to wean ourselves from folk customs, traditions, and conventionalisms. We need not look too far in our circle of friends and relatives to see the varying degrees of weaning or emancipation that others manifest. How many make conformity a sort of passion? The puppets wish to be dressed just like the other puppets. We think that we think, and then we go a step further and announce that we know. Does a drum think because it reacts noisily when struck? Is it possible that all thought is the result of forces or impressions striking our nervous system, and if there is an essence more subtle than the nervous system, they may be impacting upon that also? We have little to say about the quality of this impaction upon the senses, and hence we have a lot to learn about thoughts. Like a baby hanging by its heels, we do not think too actively until the doctor instills a sensation by slapping the posterior. A prominent mental concept, possibly an aberration, is that we think with our heads or in our heads. There is no real foundation for this concept any more than there is a foundation of any worth for the parallel or resulting concept that when the head decays, our thoughts decay and cease forever. If telepathy is possible, then it is possible that our thoughts may be sent out as a sort of electronic stream from a cranial broadcasting tower. But telepathy may also function in another manner, as a sort of mental tenuosity. However, with either explanation, we can see that the mind is not contained in or restricted to the head. Paul Brunton demonstrates several of these points in his books on yoga and the overself. Likewise, other phenomena tend to determine that the mind is independent of the body. dreams that are later verified as being actual mental visualizations of something happening some distance away at the same time as the dreaming are a good example. The phenomenal visions of seers, especially when accurate in the ability of clairvoyance, all give us reasons for accepting the theory of mental tenuosity or universal mind tapping, as opposed to taking the long odds that successful clairvoyance resulted from guessing. It is possible that the idea of thinking inside our heads comes from reasoning by elimination and the isolation of nerve responses. We can cut away most of the body and still think, or so we are led to believe. But much has been cut away from the brain by accidents and surgery, and this verified elimination of brain tissue has failed to locate a thinking center. A severing of a particular portion of the brain may cause unconsciousness, which would mean that the head contains a switchbox or relay for all body functioning. Unconsciousness is only a qualification of the thinking process, being a screen that interferes with the observation of the process. That which would appear to an observer to be unconsciousness in another may well be the detachment of the senses from their usual manner of functioning. We have the anesthetized body on the operating table, chattering distinctly about its dream. The patient is evidently unconscious. Yet when the patient awakes and remembers that of which he dreamed and chattered, it signifies that unconsciousness as observed by the doctor is not the same as was experienced by the patient. At least not always. Here we see the difference between consciousness and responsive thinking. And this makes the thought itself very elusive. Of course, we can argue about definitions in the event that someone might define dreams as other than thoughts. One of the greatest contributors to illusion and confusion is the coiner of scientific words and terms. It is the delight of men with paper laurels in sight to coin a strange word or two in writing a thesis. And it is an ensuing error for students to accept such words without proper judgment or to parlay them into another vain concept structure. Of course, at this point, we might indicate that exact definition is impossible, but we can ask for consistency and for the so-called authorities to do all possible to avoid building a fabric of thought and expounding it merely because no one is clever enough or desirous enough to immediately attack it. It is no great wonder that many psychiatrists find themselves upon another psychiatrist's couch, especially if they read one another's writings. We can take the various opinions on the attributes of the mind and note the divergence of number and types of attributes pinned on by different authors. One of these attributes is will. There are two schools of thoughts on the matter. The determinists who claim that things are predestined, which means also that we only have the choice to choose things already fated or chosen, and the libertarians who see for man various degrees of freedom in forming his environment and future. We should not jump to consciousness as a negative manner. It is possible that there is such a thing as a will, and we have no choice but to act as though we have one. However, we can look upon it in the light as to what it most likely might not be. It seems highly foolish for this milling mass called humanity to pretend to have a free will of unlimited range. Can we choose the thought that inspires us to think that we are choosing? Does the hog choose the butcher? Those who stand by fatalism are no more idiots than those who claim to be libertarians. There are philosophers on both sides. There are major religions in both camps. And as long as there is a doubt, the least we can do is refrain from actions that might result in remorse as a result of fanatical convictions in the matter. The paradox remains. It might seem egotistical to presume ourselves to be free agents, but it also seems foolish to be constrained to eternal shackles, and at the same time, to feel separate from our environment. And the fact that man is programmed to yearn for separateness brings hope that man, by some manipulation, may increase his separateness and individuality. We are almost willing to hold ourselves responsible for knowing exactly that which a creator created us for, if he will just cut the puppet strings. He can throw us in the fire if we guess wrongly. The robot bids for life. If the master puts the right amount of electronic tubes in, maybe we will be self-aware. We can expand the possibility for freedom even more. It is possible to borrow words from the Bible that the truth will make us free. The masses vegetate in slavery, but a percentage measured in very small fractions studies freedom. They create even as they were created. They generate a will, knowing it is not totally free. Their freedom consists in having yard privileges while the other convicts are restrained in the cells. Those kept in the cells may not have to crack rocks and may consider the yard convicts to be less free than themselves. There is much labor in working for freedom and often considerable scorn from the mob that languishes in its destined groove. It all comes back to this: do we really wish to find the truth, and how desperately? If knowing the truth means upsetting almost all that we have believed or have been unconsciously addicted to in the past, should we desert the path? Do we seek for euphemistic truth or for the truth regardless of how it looks? The desire that energized the beginning of the search for truth may be dissipated or deflated by our findings along the trail. Yet these same new findings will create new perspectives and a new but different desire. Does this mean that we should rebel against convention? It would be better to advise detachment from conventionality. We cannot rush out and shoot all the lawyers, judges, and theologians merely because their inconsistencies are noticeable. Such public demonstrations might edify the masses, but the masses are not interested in pursuing the truth. And the masses value rather highly many of the weavers who are able to twist an intangible bit of fuzziness into a great yarn. A word need not have a final binding meaning, but neither is it expressive of a great psychological discovery just because of its prolonged public usage. Thought is a word that is more accepted than defined. Everyone proudly lays claim to the ability to think. A process is thereby preempted without the least cerebral struggle, since man is neither able to begin thinking nor to stop it. His thinking processes originate in environmental suggestions or from previous thoughts. They end up with exhaustion or by mechanical methods of stopping consciousness. Sleep is not considered a conscious state, but even in the state of sleep, there is evidence that some mental activity continues. Men have been known to work problems in their sleep. Both the psychologist and the mystic consider the observation of the dream process and different levels of sleep as being very valuable in the study of ourselves. Scientific men are no closer than laymen to knowing the essence of thought. Most of the technical data gathered by scientists or psychologists are observations of somatic references to the thinking process. Many of these observations furnish data on reactions to suggestion or stimulus, but these data concern our sensory apparatus and a field or reaction connected with automatic reflexes more than thinking processes. We have not been able to disprove that our mind may be part of a universal mind, or that our equally elusive soul may be only an extension of a soul matrix or Brahman. We hear the words of illumined men but fail to evaluate them. I have no life but that God lives within me. I and the Father are one. You cannot find yourself unless you lose yourself in me. Great men openly indicate a knowledge of their own insignificance. The authoritative technician struts across the stage of life and bravely postulates himself. Of course, the illuminated men have been unable to prove their claim of union with the Godhead by using the implements which we might demand that they use to arrive at proof, because the intuition does not prove but aims at direct knowledge. A person may try to translate the convictions of the intuition into a logical presentation, but this is generally for the benefit of another person not yet illuminated. A person of a keen intuitive nature generally grasps the idea with a minimum amount of explanation. At this point, I would like to reiterate that no particular interpretation is being endorsed. Yet as long as the theories about a universal mind or Brahman are not disproven, they must remain a part of the answer for the unexplained phenomena of the mind, and one answer is as good as the next one if it answers with common sense and if neither is proven. In a way, these concepts do not rob us of our individuality. Even as the cells of our bodies relate to us, we may be both a separate entity, and at the same time we may be eternally tied up with all other entities who manifest mental capacity. We must admit and appreciate the paradox. It is possible to think within our heads, yet know that thinking need not be limited to the head. It is possible that we think, but that we are also a thought, a projection, or an extension. There was once a theory that thought was synaptic. The nerve ends or synapses act like a set of ignition points, and nerve impulses are forced to jump across the intervening space between the synapses. This type of theory exists only because it is more difficult to disprove than it is to accept it, especially when the disproving is attempted with the same coined words of the tradesman who concocted the theory. Saying that thought is synaptic is giving us a mechanistic explanation of thought. It is an effort to present a tangible concept. We like to be able to get our hands into abstract matters, and we feel safer if our grand theory sounds practical. However, the same technician or psychologist who pretends to build a tangible concept and who seeks justification in science and common sense is not daunted by his presumptions. And he will be the first to attack another concept builder by using not only his entire stock and trade implements, but every pretense of common sense as well. A learned philosopher or dedicated transcendentalist may devote his life to the development of a grand theory. A psychologist may cast a cursory glance at this grand theory and decide, while using the particular terminology of his trade, that the entire grand theory in question was simply a reflection of some psychotic condition of the writer. The psychologist pretends to examine the philosopher clinically and decide that the writer was merely enjoying a mental catharsis. He notes in addition that the results of the catharsis, the grand theory, or stool, upon inspection, show such ailments as the God complex, the Narcissus complex, the inferiority complex, sadistic, masochistic, Oedipus, Eros, and Thanatos complexes. And he is also guilty of the survival mania. And, of course, while the psychological high priest is making his damning interdiction, he manages to miss the point or message if the philosopher has a worthy point. The chicken may have a mental aberration, yet may produce a healthy egg. The complexes mentioned exist in all of us, but an individual may, for a period of time, favor a particular complex with more energy than his neighbor. If these complexes and drives are motivating factors peculiar to all of us, then they are not abnormalities and are not individual improprieties, but are rather functional parts. If such motivating factors were removed from the constitution of man, he would probably die. I do not wish to justify all of the conduct that results from the various complexes, and would follow this by adding that if a man is really pursuing the truth, his first line of endeavor would be the inspection of any possible complexes or drives, with the idea of not allowing any complex or energy dissipation to take precedence over the pursuit of truth. The supposition that he still struggles with complexes should not infer that he is a liar, nor prove that his motives should be regarded with suspicion simply because he displays urges or emotions. Those which are referred to as the Narcissus complex, the superiority complex, and the God complex may be the necessary pride or self-esteem that is both a motivating factor for an otherwise poorly functioning organism and a purposeful personality glue without which the various personality components or drives would become more erratic. When a better balance comes about through experience and maturity, those complexes become less significant and the person is more deeply moved or dedicated. Sadism and masochism are carryovers from our primitive carnivorous ancestry. The beast of prey is motivated or helped by sadism to survive, and the necessary victim is helped by masochism to become the contributor. True to the pattern of nature, the bird flutters before the snake, and the martyr finds and describes the bliss of his immolation. The Oedipus and electric complexes, through the conduct so motivated, receive much attention from not only our psychologists, but from the legal department of social discrimination and from the religious segment of society as well. On the other hand, homosexuality is looked upon by some psychologists as being merely a stage of development. The psychologist who wishes to serve as the high priest of nature should realize the degree of usefulness of the homosexual. And the religionist should take into account that the survival of Lot's tribe depended upon that man's relations with his daughters, while the angry God saw fit to destroy an entire city because of homosexual advances, which were not even successful and hence were not homosexual acts. Various sexual complexes are simply variations of the survival drive, and if the survival drive were removed, most of the people on the planet would be removed. The survival urge is responsible for this writing and for all scientific and transcendental quests. This does not mean that those who are inclined to search along transcendental lines will still possess the survival urge with the same urgency with which they possessed when they first began the search. The truth may develop in us a reversal of hope, and our urge may then be one of non-survival Or it may, if nothing else, change our definition of the survival as desired earlier. A very important point should not be forgotten in regard to complexes. They are sources of energy, and once they are recognized and their energy is diverted into work channels, they can aid our upward climb. To denounce them is to negate them, and to negate them is to pull up our roots. Let us move on to psychological terms that relate to mind definition. Both religion and psychology owe their origins to concepts of the psyche, anima, soul, atman, purusha, spirit, microcosm, self, I am, or whatever you wish to name the unproven essence of man. Immediately, most authors agree on one thing. Consciousness is evidence of the one who is feeling. Aquinas and Descartes both agree. But from there on, we have immediate dissembling. And it is with great difficulty that we were able to know that which any psychologist author means by any of the above terms, other than to know that he is conscious of consciousness. And the confusion will become more multiplied when we approach the terms of esoteric religion. The so-called science of psychology is based upon the study of the behavior of the individual and is so defined by authors of psychological texts or by the masses. It has little to do with exact knowledge about the essence of the psyche, the essence of man, the limits of the self, or the true origins of the behavior of the individual. Psychology uses a yardstick which it calls normality. And from that, in turn, is spawned a definition for sanity. Without knowing the true essence of thought or the mechanisms of thought, the psychologist shall presume to know which thoughts are healthy ones. And when the opus writer runs short of material, he resorts to telling the public that which it wants to hear. I do not wish to discourage the study of psychological works. I would rather like to be able to create some sort of sieve to separate the gold from the dross, and thus save the youthful seeker a few months or years of labor under the impression that just any book is an authority. One good test for any work is the application of the work to actual experience. If there exist cases which are not included in an author's theory, then the theory is lacking. If there are cases which throw the book in doubt, then there is another book with a better explanation. We must, of course, pause and reflect. So timid and cocksure have become the pseudo-psychologists that they have decided to measure intelligence without first defining it. So what do we have? We have a meaningless charade with which school teachers or personnel interviewers fritter away their time. It becomes a dignified sort of eeny, meeny, miny, moe. As yet, there is no valid calibration of the mental qualities of men in relation to one another. An IQ test determines only that which the group being tested reacted as they did individually and with varied responses to varied symbols. If the tests have to do with numbers or mathematics, then a person who can count on the fingers may look like a genius alongside of a person who coordinates in generalities, or who reaches conclusions intuitively. It has not been too many years since psychology lay in the womb of theology. This parent had a peculiar authority in the Middle Ages, and the fetus has inherited some of its parents' facetiousness. At an auto da fe, it was left up to the theologian to decide if the victim were to have the devil burned out of him or be locked up in a dungeon with his presumed insanity. They had various ways of determining his sanity, such as the ordeal of fire and the augury of screams. We have the same thing today. Pompous alienists today who have not the candor or honesty to stand upon a witness stand and simply tell the court they know nothing about sanity or insanity will utter jargon in a convincing tone which neither they, the court, nor the victim can understand or debate. They are driven by a trade survival urge. If the court recognizes them, they must in turn not let the court down when the court needs some help with the hatchet. I must admit that all legal procedure is designed with good intent, and it must continue until the human family evolves something fairer. However, we can avoid sitting in judgment or posing as alienists. Because the masses have a certain fever, there is no excuse for us to jump up and pretend to be the zeitgeist. The office of judge is the result of the masses' illusion that they can institute a system that will protect them but never take away their just rights. All this is born of fear. The next illusion is that the judge, and this term applies to a jury as well as to an individual, is able to determine guilt. Not even a guilty plea is proof of guilt. Masochists have been known to plead guilty to the crimes of others. Thus we can see that much suffering results from unclear thinking, and the tolerance of one illusion creates more illusions, so that the pattern of wrong thinking becomes so interlaced and interdependent that many people imagine the human menagerie to be an articulate and perfect entity just because it is complex. Weakness employs bombastic oratory. I would like to make a final observation in regard to psychological research, such as is carried on currently. The psychologists would like to copy other material scientists, so much attention is paid to graphs and every little whim is pulled and charted. This is like making notes on the results of fertilizers upon the growth of grass, when the real problem is to determine the essence of the core of the earth.